Hey guys, welcome. It's good to be back with you again. This is our fourth in the Honest Conversation series. I don't need to make much of an introduction. Just going to tell you that this morning we're dealing with the topic of miracles. You'll hear me talk a little bit about how I arrived at this topic for discussion. But I think every one of us in our lives, from one time to another, we long for God to show up in some supernatural way. So we're going to look at that today. We're going to see what that reveals about us, what God's responses reveal about what we can at times expect from Him. One of the key points that I want to emphasize, and listen for this theme to be echoed repeatedly throughout the morning, is that relationships are unique, distinct, individual, that what God does in your life and how God and you relate is going to be somewhat and at times completely different than the way God and someone else relate. So men, as always, I hope you're blessed. I hope you're encouraged. Please consider sharing this material with someone else. Just get that out there. There's probably someone in your life that needs to hear this particular podcast. And hope to see you again next week. Have a great week. All right, gentlemen. Good morning. We're in our fourth week now, the topic Honest Conversations. It's a discussion about various components of prayer. So just to bring everybody up to speed, we said in week one that the evidence of Scripture as a whole is that God is eager and very interested in relating to us. And as a matter of fact, in many occasions, God takes the initiative. That by itself is a pretty interesting thing to think about, because most of us think that we take the initiative, that we start the ball rolling, that we reach out to God. Sometimes it's very clear that God starts the conversation, but other times, as we're going to look at today, it's God working in ways that we don't yet detect that is the initial overture of the conversation. Well, in week two, we looked at the fact that sometimes we're so busy doing religious stuff that we don't even notice God when God takes the initiative. And because we tend to go about things sometimes in all the wrong ways, we miss opportunities to have fellowship with God because we're so busy doing our own thing to pursue God. Well, then last week, the overall theme, and we don't have time to review it a lot, but the overall theme was that there are sometimes things that we do, just the same as in every other relationship, where we put a break in the relationship. And then the question comes in, how do I restore a relationship? And why, if God is eager to have relationship, why is it that we can tend to stay outside of fellowship for so long? And we looked last week, and this is the big thing to remember, that we don't rely on anything within us for that restoration. We don't say, in the end, and this is, these are all these mental gymnastics that we do. We don't in the end say, well, God's missing out on a really good deal. I'm actually pretty good. I'm actually a kind of a nice guy. It would really be sad for God to miss out on having a fellowship with me. And so really, I guess God would think it an honor if I came back to Him. But instead, all the while, we rely on the character qualities of God that He's revealed. The two character qualities that we said were God is loving, God is merciful. And so as long as we remember those two things, God is loving, God is merciful, and we take them in the right context, then we have reason to approach God and say, God, it's not because of anything that I've done that I'm coming back to You and want to say I'm sorry and I'd like this relationship to be restored. The only reason that I can come to You is because I can count on the fact that while You are just, You are also loving, You're also merciful, You're also kind. All right. You know, I thought initially that this was going to be a 3 or maybe a 4 week series. Things never quite work out the way I planned. I kind of suspected that I needed to do at least a little bit more. Look at that. He came prepared with a pen and now there's no handouts for the morning. So the one time you came prepared and there's nothing to do with that preparation. So, last Saturday, I felt pretty good about what we covered. I was kind of okay with where we were. But But I wasn't quite sure what we were going to talk about this week. Seems fitting that since this is a discussion on prayer, that I would pray about a topic. And I did. So I went to sleep Saturday night, and I was clueless. I had no idea. I mean, not that I was worried that I was going to be at a loss for something to say, but it's like, so Sunday morning I wake up. Now, you can do with this what you want. I mean, you can question this, you can doubt this, whatever. I woke up, and the split second I woke up, there's this one word came into my mind: miracles. That's it, miracles. Now, I'm really looking for more, because I'm thinking that a one-word solution is not enough. And I honestly had to say to God, that's it? Just miracles, that's it. And that was all I got. So today, we're going to look at miracles. But as a matter of fact, it's really not a bad topic. So what I'd like us to consider here is two words. The first we've talked about a lot. That's relationship. Here's the other word. Now, the good news is if you brought your own paper, you'll have something to write on if you'd like to take notes. So those are the two words, relationship and expectation. And the premise here is that there are no real, genuine relationships without there being some level of expectation. So what are your expectations? Let's say the closer the relationship, the deeper the relationship, the more important the relationship, what can we say about expectations? Yes, or what kind of expectations are reciprocally placed on us. So if you have someone that you know casually from work, what's the level of expectation? Theirs for you or yours for them? It's pretty minimal, right? Okay, now let's move to the other end of the spectrum. And I'll make the big leap of faith here and assume that your relationship with your wife is at least one of the significant relationships in your life. Okay, so assuming that is true in your case, what's the level of expectation between you and she and you? Significantly more, isn't it? As a matter of fact, there's not only, and this is where we get into the challenges, there's not only the expectations that you understand, other expectations that perhaps have been placed on you that you're not even aware of. And because this is a men's study, we can say this, and the women could say it in a women's only study, but you married someone who doesn't always have reasonable expectations. Isn't that good to hear? You married someone who might at times have sinful expectations. So, and the same is true for each of us, right? So because we are limited beings, finite beings, we have expectations for other people, we can place unnecessary burdens or unnecessary expectations on them. So just thoughtfully here, would anybody be bold enough to offer up a time when at one time in your relationship with some significant person in your life, you had an expectation and it kind of got ferreted out that might not have been a reasonable expectation, that you were placing too much of an expectation on the person?
Eventually, you know, we had to talk, you know, just like, what do you expect from me?
All right, well, let's, before we go further, I hadn't even expected to do this part, but what sorts of expectations do we have? And I don't mean specific expectations, but in general terms, when I'm in a relationship with anybody, what sort of broad sort of categories of expectation would I have? Okay. Boy, now you're really pushing the boundaries, aren't you? You weren't talking about a husband-wife relationship.
I'm talking about work.
Okay. Maybe you guys did really good. I mean, honestly, the list is longer than I expected. I know I told you to be broad brush, and you're thinking, now let's narrow it down a little bit. Are there any specific expectations that maybe you came into the marriage with or into the friendship with? I mean, concrete, I want you to do this, or I don't want you to do that. Because these were good. I hope I didn't erase this too soon, which I probably did. So, and since I started from the bottom, it's too late if you didn't get that written down. Too bad. Right. Who starts erasing from the bottom when the bottom is free? What about it? Yeah, see, that's a practical one, cooking dinner. That maybe, so I'm a really bad cook, so, okay, so that's his expectation. Now, here is another ground rule that I want us to establish right now. I'm not sure if we've said this in this study, but every relationship is different. So, if I were to go into your house and watch the relationship between you and your wife, it would be different than if I were to go into his house and watch the relationship between he and his wife and so forth.
It's got to be what works at your house.
It's got to be what works at your house. Do you and I ever assume that everybody's relationship with God is the same as every other one's?
Yes, we do.
You didn't even hesitate or skip a beat about that. So I want you to understand this, that your relationship with God, while there will be certain parameters, there will be certain general expectations. As a matter of fact, the first list that we made is probably a good list of reasonably universal expectations that we should have for relationship with God, and incidentally, that God should expect from us. But the second list, the one that we're making now, might be a little bit more personal and individual. Yours might look different than mine. Okay, so he had a good one. And I'm not going to write these down because these might be, well, they might not apply to everybody because they're personal. So he said, and I'm putting a few more words in his mouth than he did, but I'm really not skilled in the kitchen. And it would be nice if you happen to be more skilled and not less skilled. It would be nice if you were perhaps to make the arrangements for food preparation. Is that a diplomatic way of saying that? Okay. Any other expectations?
If you're married, expect your wife to
Okay, so he has a sexist expectation. He says, yes, he is. Okay, so one of his expectations, and remember, so he said, well, I'd like my wife to maybe feed me once a day or something. Randall said, I'd like to come home to a reasonably clean house. That means I wouldn't like to trip over the laundry that I throw on the floor in the morning. I'd like it to be picked up by the time I get home. Any others?
I think a bad expectation I've had is that I would always feel loved and adored, like we were in a dating mood.
Okay. Has that expectation been deflated a little bit?
No, it's a lot.
It's been.
You gotta help that. It's gotta part that help that take place.
Yeah, but that wasn't an expectation.
Oh.
I don't even have a recliner yet, so I'm not sure when that comes in the picture.
That'd be a little low.
So, inadvertently perhaps, and in a humorous way, you've led us to the next phase of the discussion, and that is that there are expectations that I have going into a relationship, and I might over a period of time refine the expectations. I might realize that the expectations are naive. I might expect even that they're perhaps sinful, or at very least self-oriented. That they don't address the needs of both parties in the relationship. They're primarily concerned about what one party can get from the other party in the relationship. And there's those kinds of expectations. All right. Do we carry any of that understanding or any of that baggage into our relationship with God? And remember that we're saying that we think of God and the relationship that we have with Him, and we're using our significant relationships sort of metaphorically to understand a relationship with God. Well, the answer would have to be yes. That we have sometimes unrealistic or misinformed, childish, not childlike, but childish expectations for God. So last week we gave God a few roles. Actually, God gave Himself those roles, and we've learned about them. So He said that one of those roles is God is a king. Another one is that God is a just judge. Another one that God is our Father. And then finally, God is our friend. All right, so in light of that, and we say that we are in relationship with God, and every relationship carries mutual expectations about it, we've already said that the deeper, the more connected the relationship, the more expectations that each party will probably have of the other. What kind of expectations do I have in a relationship with a God who fills all of these roles? Okay, so while you're contemplating that, we've already established that sometimes we have expectations for those close to us and they don't measure up. So you can think of times when you've had an expectation for your wife or for a close co-worker or something, and they didn't. They couldn't measure up. So there's times when we have expectations and people can't deliver. They don't have the time, they don't have the money, they don't have whatever it is. There's simply limitations. But there's times we know when people could say yes and they choose not to. Then we got to wonder why. Well, the thing with God is that God, by declaration, numerous times in this book, and it's up to you whether you decide that we should take components of this book literally or not. It's up to you whether you think that this is just interesting and poetic language or whether we're really to take this seriously. So let's take a look at a couple of verses. We're going to, because this is on miracles, we're going to be desperate today, and we're just actually going to use the Bible as our textbook because I don't know what else to do in this case.
This.
All right, so I'm going to, while you turn over to Psalm, let's say 33, I'm going to go back to Philippians here. I'm going to read to us some stuff that's really familiar. You're just getting to Psalm 33. Do you think you can do that patiently, Scott, and just wait there for me to get there? Or do you have more unreasonable expectations for me right now? Okay, so in light of this recent conversation, we're going to start with verse 5 in the fourth chapter of Philippians, and we're going to say, "Let your reasonableness be known to everyone. The Lord is at hand." We're going to come back to that phrase later, but I want you to remember it. The Lord is at hand. And then he says, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication, with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." So what's he saying? Anything in your life that concerns you. What concerns us? Money? Health? Relationships? The new car we want to buy next month? I don't know. What concerns us? We have a lot of concerns, don't we? And Paul says, don't leave anything off the table. Absolutely anything that is of a concern to you in relationship, you can bring that to God. These are not my words. So here we see, it's not like, okay, if you got something big and you can't solve it yourself, and you're not willing to tolerate it for the rest of your life, if those preconditions are met, then bring it to God. Paul says, whatever it is, the day-to-day concerns, the hour-to-hour concerns, the big concerns, bring them to God. Show of hands. How many of you have prayed for something and not gotten it? How many of you had a cup of coffee in your hand and couldn't raise your hand? See, I saw a couple of guys. There you go. Okay. Because every hand should have gone up there. All right. Now, Paul. This same Paul. The guy who wrote those words. Let me find it here. All right, so he's talking to the Corinthians here. This is 2 Corinthians. So if you know something about the book, he spends a lot of time. This is one of his personal testimony times in the Scripture. And he's trying to state his authority and why he has credibility or should have credibility among these Corinthians, that he's not just some common schmuck, that he really is a man who has some connection with God. And he's trying to say this humbly, but he even knows as he's writing it, he has to qualify it a couple of times and say, this is crazy, it sounds as if I'm boasting, I'm not trying to boast, but it sounds as if I am. And so here we are at chapter 12. I must go on boasting, though there is nothing to be gained by it. And then he talks about this revelation that he has from God. And he says, I can't tell whether this was just a mental experience or whether this was actually a bodily experience. It's like I was not aware specifically of how this happened, but I was caught up to heaven and I saw things that most human beings never see. But then he says, so to keep me from being conceited because of the surpassing greatness of this revelation, in other words, because God showed me this stuff that most people never get to see, and I might have gotten all puffed up in myself and said, I'm really something because God doesn't show this to everybody, so apparently I must be really special, otherwise God wouldn't have showed this to me. So to keep me from thinking that way, he says, a thorn was given me in the flesh. Okay, so we've all read this verse countless times, right? A messenger of Satan to harass me and keep me from becoming conceited. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me, but he said to me, now remember, this is the same Paul whom we just saw said what? Any concern you have is fair game. Put it on the table. Let it be known to God. Let it be known that you're concerned about it. Now, I know that seems a little amusing because after all, God should know it already, right? What's the point in telling God about something that you're concerned about if God should already know about it? But Paul still says, get this floated out in the relationship. Because one of the qualities that we saw was openness. Another one of the qualities that was mentioned in that first list was compassion. So I should want to think that God cares, right? Don't you? I mean, you come home to your wife and you've just broken your leg or something. You don't want your wife to say, boy, that sucks to be you, doesn't it? Well, see ya. I mean, you want a little bit more understanding, do you not? And yet, what does Paul say? Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this. There's an intensity there. But he said, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Well then, Paul says, therefore I will boast all the more gladly because of my weakness. So in place of the word weakness, if you'd like to insert the biggest dilemma, the biggest challenge that you have, that you figure God has an answer. Can you see that? Some of you shouldn't have any problem at all seeing that. It's the biggest stumbling block in your life right now. Is there really a God? Because I keep asking about this and nothing changes. All right, so here's Paul. Make your request known. Now we're going to turn over to Psalms. You ready, Scott?
Yes.
Okay. So we're going to start with Psalm 33, the sixth verse. We're going to jump around a little bit. But by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their hosts. He gathers the waters of the sea as a heap, and he puts the deep in the storehouses. Okay, it's nice poetic language. What's being said? More specifically. Okay, remember our topic for the morning is miracles. Maybe we should define a miracle first, before we go any further. How would you define a miracle?
It tells Saints God's responsible for this. Everything we see, it didn't, you know, evolve and just happen. He created it. He's responsible. Everything comes from him.
Okay, in the Bill?
Something that happens in our life that's kind of beyond our understanding.
Okay, so there's an understanding component. We're going to introduce a few more. So let me return to that, but let's think of miracles as things that for right now, not only don't we have an explanation for, but they act outside, at very least, of our understanding of natural law. That we can't explain them based on the systems and procedures that normally produce certain results.
Five senses, all that.
The body of human knowledge that we have thus far, that has been accumulated by humans since the beginning of our existence, does not account for why this happened. Let's call it that. So when we read this, by the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and by the breath of his mouth, all their hosts, here's what's being said. Have you ever taken your car to the garage and the mechanic was stumped? Because he didn't build it. He's just charged with working on it. And while he understands it pretty well, he may not understand it all. When we come to God and we make our requests known to God, we're not coming to someone who's just the caretaker of the universe. He's the systems builder. He's the systems creator. Everything in the universe he built from scratch is what this says. So when I come to him with a problem, he can't very well back out of it by saying, geez, I don't understand that. I have no idea why that is happening in your life. So this is the first principle. And this is so unsettling, honestly. Remember what Paul said about the thorn in the flesh? It doesn't go away. Ask anything of God. Ask anything you want. God sees. Let's read on. Let the earth fear the Lord, for all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spoke and it came to be, and he commanded and it stood firm. Now we jump down to verse 13. The Lord looks down from heaven and he sees all the children of man from where he sits enthroned. He looks out on all the inhabitants of the earth. He who fashions the hearts of them all and observes their deeds. So the next thing, principle number one, God made everything, so God understands everything. So God cannot plead ignorance. Principle number two, according to this, God sees everything. So God can't plead when we come to Him. And remember, this is relationship. This is personal. This is intimate. And we have expectations for God, do we not? Let's just be honest. If you could be candid right now, and if we had the time, I'll guarantee you, every one of you, if you gave a little thought to it, could fill at least one side of a yellow legal pad with your expectations from God, for God. And God right here, through His Word, is saying, I'm capable of meeting those expectations. There's no getting around it. I created everything. I see everything. What's missing? Just stop right there before we go on. What's missing? I made it. I see it. I can do something about it, right? That's the thing, that control. What's the other thing? Yes, I care. So I made it. I see it. I have the ability to do something about it. And I actually care about it. Verse 18. Behold, the eyes of the Lord are on those who fear Him, on those whose hope is who hope in His steadfast love, that He may deliver their souls from death and keep them alive in famine. We're going to go back and read that because this is really powerful. Behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear Him, on those whose hope is in His steadfast love. So does that sort it out a little bit? So over here it says that God's eyes are on all the children of man. Here it says, behold, the eye of the Lord is on those who fear Him. So it's implying that while God sees the dilemmas and the stresses and the pressures of every human being on earth, that He's intimately attuned and interested in the needs of those who fear Him. So what would we say fear Him means?
I think that's for reverence and respect.
Reverence, respect, and so we'd say in relationship with Him. And incidentally, aren't those, not reverence, but isn't respect one of the qualities that we wrote on the board? Sure. And then here is our expression. Our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. For our heart is glad in Him because we trust in His holy name. Let your steadfast love, O Lord, be upon us. Okay, we're going to jump over to Psalm 34. We've read some components of this psalm before, but I think it's worth reading a little bit again. It's a little bit repetitious. The eye of the Lord are toward the righteous and His ears toward their cry. Isn't this challenging? So let's just be honest right here. The eye of the Lord sees our circumstances. His ear is toward their cry. What happens when we know, according to this, or we long to believe? Because what we're looking at is this can be a real faith buster. Let's parenthetically insert this idea. Do you know people who have walked away from their relationship with Christ because of the doubts that they have about this very thing? So this is really big stuff. And what I dare to say is that in every human being's life, there is going to come one or more faith crises that could break your faith down and cause you to walk away. And let's remember, apart from, so we'll use marriage as an analogy here. We know that there are some couples today who get the prenup, you know, the I'm walking out the door before I ever quite walk in the door, and I want to make sure that I walk out the door with at least as much as I walked in the door with. Okay, that's kind of like not having a great hope for an enduring relationship. But those people aside, most people don't say the day they get married, boy, I can't wait for this to end. They're not looking that way. They're not expecting that to happen. And I don't think for the most part that people enter into relationship with Christ thinking, well, this is just for a season in my life, and then I'll outgrow this and I'll move on to the next thing. This is a permanent relationship. So 10 or 15 years later when somebody walks, and sometimes it doesn't even take that long, 10 or 15 years later when somebody walks out of relationship with Christ, what's happened in their life? Huh?
Something bad.
Their expectations weren't met. There you go. Their expectations were not met. Did you remember what we said about expectations as human? Are you wagging your finger at me, son?
Because I think it's also that they didn't meet the expectations of others.
Are you talking about the marriage or the God?
When it walks out.
Okay.
I was thinking with God, and there's all kind of people like that, unfortunately. You know, it just didn't go long enough, didn't walk that through long enough. But there's two people that are, we would know their names, famous, and you hear their story. One is the comedian, somebody may, I think I'm saying his name right, Ricky Gervais. He's British, he's the winner of the Office series. He did the Office
yeah.
in Britain and all that. You listen to him long enough, man, he is anti-God, he is blaspheming God almost. But you go back into his early life as a kid, and this is exactly where this comes from, these expectations.
Right.
And he was raised by, I think, a mother's godly, and I think just disappointment as a teenager, young man, and now he's blaming God. And the same thing with Ted Turner, you know, Ted Turner, same thing in his life early on, and there was this belief in God and family, but these expectations he believes God did not meet. Now he is anti-God.
Right. That's what I was saying. I didn't have stories though.
Okay.
Examples.
Okay, well listen then, the next time that you have something that you'd like to say, you just walk over and get John, and John will say it for you, okay?
But that's how we tag team and we help each other, so.
Because my expectations for you communicating clearly are pretty low.
Wow. Did you say my expectations of you being kind?
Dan, you should have no expectations for me being kind, and you know that, right?
Hey, Dan, we'll see you in December.
So, this is the first part of getting our heads around this whole idea. So we know the facts about God, but we experience things that seem to contradict some of the facts that we know, and couple that to the fact that we sometimes have reasonable, unreasonable expectations. So basically, what we said here is that when we go to God, that the scriptures declare, certainly, that God made it. God sees it. And this, incidentally, this next part, while you might think, well, the two are the same, they're not. The difference between a deist and a theist, anybody know that? A deist is a person who says, well, God just put things in motion. And there were people, there are, still are people that believe this, that God just put things in motion, that He started the universe going and then basically took off for galaxies unknown. That He's not involved in the day-to-day runnings and affairs of things. And that's why we have to say God made it, God sees it, God controls it. Can I do that? Right? Yeah. And finally, God cares about it. Now, in one way or another, the scriptures make all four of those points clear. God made it, God sees it, God controls it, God cares about it. Let's turn over to Genesis 18. But incidentally, before we go any further, can you see why people's faith is eroded when the scriptures in multiple ways over the course of multiple books declare these truths again and again, and yet people do exactly what Paul told them to do? They present their needs to God and nothing happens. You understand? So when we say we're in need of a miracle, in other words, we're in need, we have an expectation that God is going to intervene in our life in a supernatural way, and nothing happens, we have some conclusions to draw. Let me read this from Abraham, and then we'll look at another couple things that we need to look at here. So you know the story. Abram's there at his tent one day. Yes?
Which chapter?
Oh, it's that pesky detail again, isn't it? It's chapter 18.
Here we go.
Yeah, we are. And there's really, it's not as if you have to follow along here. So Abram's there at his tent. He's milling about. He's hanging around one day. And these three guys show up. And it's clear from the way he interacts with them that he's reverencing them immediately. He senses there's something extremely important about this meeting and about these people. We don't know exactly how he knows that. But he sets about to cater to them almost immediately. Now there's a certain amount of hospitality that would have been expected. It would have been the custom. But remember, Abram is the dignitary, the head of this whole house. So when two heads of state meet, you don't see one groveling and bowing before the other and rushing off to serve the other while the other head of state just sits there and is served. Right? I mean, at least you shouldn't. So when Abram does this, it's suggesting that he clearly understands that the people that are in front of him, that are in his company right now, are somehow greater than he is. And after having been served a meal and eating, and it says that Abram stands there and is available to serve them throughout the meal, and they said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And he said, "She's in the tent." Always a good place for the woman to be. So that's something I can say in the... You know you were thinking it sometimes too.
Actually, I was thinking, you debate Paul's thorn in the flesh. I heard somebody say, see, this proves that he was married.
The Lord said, I will return. All right, come on, I'm trying to rein it back in. We had our fun. The Lord will surely return to you about, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now Abram and Sarah were old and advanced in years. The way of women had ceased with Sarah. So in other words, biologically, this is saying she ain't having kids no more. Everything that makes it possible for this woman to have kids, that part of her life is all behind her. And so Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I'm worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure?" And the Lord said to Abram, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything..." Okay, this is God Himself talking. This is not people talking about God. This is God in flesh, pre-incarnate revelation. God is saying about Himself, "Is anything too hard for me? Are you really doubting me right now?" It's hard to get the feel for the way in which this is being said. Is it being posed with a little bit of pain and hurt at the doubt? Is it being posed with just a confident certainty? Is anything too hard for me? We don't know, but nonetheless, it's a declaration. Is anything too hard for the Lord? At the appointed time, I will return. About this time next year, and Sarah shall have a son. So he repeats himself. Just to double down on this confirmation, this is going to happen. You notice there's crickets on Abram's part right then? It's like he doesn't quite know what to make of this. He believes, but he's not sure. And it can't help his confidence to have Sarah in the background saying, you know how old I am, right? You know what's going on in my life, right? You know all the hot flashes I've been through, right? You were around for that whole decade of our marriage. You know all about that, right? And incidentally, buddy, I know what's going on in your life, okay? The plumbing ain't working real well on your part either. It's a men's study. We can be real, right? So he doesn't say anything. But here's the interesting thing. We move from that. From God is going to bring good into somebody's life, and the woman says, that isn't happening. And the man says, boy, I hope that's true. And we move on to the next story. Do you know what the next story is? The same three guys traveling to Sodom and Gomorrah. And in that situation, Abram pleads and begs and entreats these three people. Remember, it starts out, and I think it's 50. If 50 people can be found that are good in this city, you won't destroy it, right? And then it's pretty soon, it's half that. And it gets down to, like, there's something like 10 people. If you can find just 10 people in this city. How is it that the same guy who's quiet in this matter between he and his wife and whether they can have a kid, all of a sudden has confidence in God to be able to, or whoever these beings are in his mind, that they can make a difference in the life of this city? What does that say about us? So we can pray about certain kinds of miracles that are abstract and that are totally beyond our control, but when something is intimate and up close, we struggle to believe it. In other words, is it easier to pray for God to feed the starving people in Africa or divert the hurricanes that are headed toward Hawaii? We're already got there. I don't know. I'm a little out of touch with the news some days. Is it easier for us to pray those kinds of prayers than it is to pray, I have an immediate financial need which cannot be met without your help, and I need your...
You have to expose yourself.
And this is the personalness, the intimacy of relationship, isn't it? And this is where expectations are put to the test. So when God does or doesn't, and somebody had their hand up and I'll get to that in a minute, but when God does or doesn't answer the prayer about the hurricane in Hawaii or the people in Sodom and Gomorrah, we can say, well, God is sovereign and just, and that was His will. It's easy to say. God destroys the city over from you and He doesn't touch your house. We can say, well, God is sovereign and just. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Right? But when God doesn't do something in my life or yours after I have poured all of my heart, my soul, and my expectation into the pleading, what does that leave me with in the relationship? Maybe more. Maybe more than doubt. Who had their hand up?
I was going to say, I know for myself, very much a reality in my life, has been for about the last 3 years. Like what you were saying, it's very easy to, for instance, pray for other people. You know, people, oh, I need your prayer. You don't have to know how to pray for them. I can't believe you, I would believe you, whatever. But I find it extremely difficult to pray for myself. And I realize it's because I want to keep my faith insulated. I want to keep my faith untested. What if something doesn't happen for me, I'm going to know exactly how God failed me. For someone else, they can look at their life and go, well, look how God helped you over here. Look how God helped you over there. I can point them in a direction, but I'm not going to know the little details of how God failed. And my faith will remain insulated because I don't see that. But in my life, I will know every little tiny thing where God did not come through. And so praying for myself is extremely difficult. Always has been.
And parallels what I was thinking of. Because when you pray for others, it's a distance from yourself. When you pray for yourself, you really have to have faith when you pray for yourself. And then the other thing is, the whole expectation thing is you get depressed, you get disappointed when things don't turn out the way you want. But the realization is, the result of your prayers are God's will, not your will. And our expectations are sometimes not met, but our path is limited. God's path is infinite. And it's, I struggle with that a lot, where, you know, when God. And I just sat, and part of my thing is patience. I really need to develop more patience. I've gotten better from where I used to be, but I struggle with patience a lot because things don't happen in my time. And that creates a lot of, you know, disappointment and recalculations. It's kind of like the GPS, you know, I'm constantly recalculating. Because my time frames are never met. My milestones are always quicker than God's milestones. So, I mean, on a personal level, the prayer, it's very, very humbling because it's so close to what I see, what God sees, and there's that big gap in between that is a timeline that is undetermined.
And yet, if there is to be, and you know, you nailed something very important there. If there is to be intimacy in relationship and not distance, remember what we said, and I think it was the second week, that all relationship involves substantive risk. That you cannot enter into a real relationship with any other human being without placing in harm's way something that you value. So what is the thing that we value about God that, or about ourselves, that we are reluctant to place in harm's way by praying intimately and personally for the big things in life? And I think we've already said it. My trust in God could be permanently shattered if this isn't answered. That's possible. My understanding of who God is and how He cares for me might be permanently altered. Or my understandings might simply need to grow. And it's why I think we need to look at relationship with God in the same way that we look at covenant relationship and marriage. That's why God describes His relationship with us as covenant. Because if marriage is based on met expectations and the first time a legitimate met expectation is not met, that means I'm out the door, then isn't the same thing going to be true in my relationship with God? When expectations remain unmet, I'm out of here. What's God inviting us to? Yeah, but in the day-to-day, what is God inviting us to? Relationship that is loyal in spite of sometimes. Relationship that trusts. God says, right, that you should put all this before Him because everything works together, right? For the good of who? How many of those? All of those. You have a family? Most of us do, right? You have kids at home? Some of you do. You ever tried to make all the kids happy at the same time? Have you ever witnessed in your house an effort to make one child happy, and in the process of making one child happy, you anger three? Well, if you have four, that is. But you know what I'm saying. Hey, are any of us ever empathetic toward God? I wonder. I mean, you think it's tough when you've got three kids at home. How would you like to have millions of them? And I realize that's God's fault. Understand, He could have stopped this. He could have, I don't know, whatever God would do to not have more kids. Like, is there such a thing as a divine vasectomy or something? I don't know. And I'm not being irreverent here. But God has willingly allowed this to persist. So if God is loving and caring and compassionate and all-powerful, and God says no to something, what should we be looking for? An exit or an understanding? So, and sometimes we don't like an understanding. Have you ever gone through a painful period in your marriage that produced good in the end? Or are you just in the middle of a painful period and it's called marriage and you hope it will end? Let's look at the next component of what is miracle. So, yes?
I think with the personal prayers too, the vulnerability, we know there's accountability. But I went to the hospital and visited with Michael Petrucca, and it got this mask on, doesn't look good. I can pray for him, but I got a cut in my back. I've had a pre-surgery evaluation, and it's hard for me to pray believing that God would heal me because there's accountability. Where the Bible says the prayers of a righteous man are both powerful and effective. I've got work to do. That I have to have the relationship. And I don't necessarily believe that. I believe that when I pray for someone else, God will see, I'll come up with the crappy excuse and justification, and God will see my heart and He'll bypass that I'm a sinner. But when I pray for myself, I know I need to be right with God. And so sometimes I won't pray for myself. And it can almost be condemning in myself. That I think of 1 Peter, where he talks about how we're to treat our wives as the weaker vessel and to treat them good. And then it says something about so that nothing will hinder our prayers. There are things I do that hinder my prayers that I will justify. Well, God's not going to hinder my prayers when I'm praying for someone else. That it's a personal reward in prayer versus God calling me to a right relationship. So the prayer period is powerful and effective.
In addition to the blunt statement there, there was another statement that just corroborates what we've said thus far. That is that relationships are all personal. They're all slightly different. They're all intimate. And that they all involve what's going on between you personally and the other party. So everything in that dynamic of your relationship with God is connected somehow to every other thing. And so what he said is, in essence, if I make an appeal to God for somebody else, God's going to look at them and their need, and I'm just this almost insignificant vessel that might kind of leverage a little bit and invite God into that other person's thing. But when I'm inviting God specifically, intimately into the affairs of my life, I almost don't have the courage to do it because I know what's broken in my life. And I know how unworthy I am. I know. And incidentally, this is a good point to bring this up. Do you remember the boat and Peter and the fish? And Jesus is done teaching. He's used the boat and he knows that the gang has not caught anything all night. And so he says, just push the boat off a little bit and throw your net over. And, you know, Peter, he says, well, okay, fine. If it'll shut you up, fine. You know nothing about fishing, but if it will make you happy, fine. Let's go out into the water and we'll pretend that this is going to work. And we know what happens. And the nets are full and they need more help because the nets are overflowing. What's Peter's response when he actually encounters the miracle? He's actually frightfully uncomfortable with it. As a matter of fact, his first request is what? Just go away from me. Because when I see myself in the context of you and I understand who I am and I understand who you are, and the miracle makes that possible, it's interesting, the teaching didn't make that possible. He just heard all that teaching, and that didn't do anything for him. As a matter of fact, by the way the story is worded, we'd have to think that at the end of all of the teaching, Peter still thinks, this guy knows nothing about fishing, and this is a dumb idea. But at the end of the miracle, he's acutely aware of who he is and who God is. So my question is, suppose that God did grant the answer that you've been praying for. Suppose you had the courage to pray. And maybe we don't, but suppose you had the courage to pray and God did show up. Would you be comfortable then? Would you be happy then? Or would you maybe be more uncomfortable than you were before God showed up? as if comfort is somehow the benchmark of a good relationship. And that would imply that actually, what do we want in a relationship? Happiness, satisfaction, contentment, and comfort. Right? We're guys, so a little sex thrown into boot. Okay, but that apart. You know, we're trying to keep this somewhat family, okay? What does God hope for in relationship with us? Is that his ultimate goal, that we just be comfortable and content and happy? As long as we are comfortable, content, and happy, can any growth really take place? How alert are you when you're comfortable? When you're scared out of your wits or in pain, are you alert? Is everything in your body heightened and sensitive? Yes, of course it is. Sometimes the only way that God can get our attention and knock us out of our discomfort is when he places us in difficult situations that heighten our awareness of danger or pain or something else. And what is our first response in those cases? Get me out of this mess. The first off-ramp from this, I want it. And is it then possible that we're praying for status quo? Is it possible that the prayer that we're praying to God is, please get me back to comfort because I really don't want to learn what I could learn, see what I could see, or become what I could become? And I'm just saying. All right. So let's take a look at the next component of miracles. And the scriptures talk about God's ongoing providential care. What does that mean? Okay, here's the way Moses describes it. The people are coming into a good new land, and he says to them, when you arrive in this land that God has prepared for you, and God will have been a partner with you in chasing the current inhabitants out of the land. And when you get there and you start to live in houses that you didn't build and you harvest crops that you didn't plant, and as a matter of fact, in the following seasons, and although this is not said in the text, they would have understood it. When you actually walk out the following spring and plant in the field that you didn't turn into a field, you know how big a deal it was to make a field out of something that wasn't a field? When you do all of that stuff, don't then say to yourself, well, I did all this in my own strength. But remember the God who provided the means for you to become wealthy. So here's the way this looks. Let's imagine that you've got a 16-year-old daughter and that she needs to go somewhere, and she comes to you and says, Dad, I'd like to borrow the car. So Greg probably has had this scenario happen a few times. Okay, so you gulp a little, you think, and you say, sure, because the daughter has a goal, right? She wants to get somewhere. You have provided the system that makes it possible for that girl to get to where she wants to go. But have you taken her there? No. What does she have to do? She has to get in the car. She has to drive there, right? She has to obey all the rules. As a matter of fact, she can do a lot of dumb things between the time she turns the ignition on and does or doesn't get to her destination and safely back home, right? So a lot of that is her responsibility, but could she have gotten there if you hadn't provided the car? I mean, in this scenario, no, she couldn't have. So Greg, in his providential care for his family, has made everything possible for his daughter to get there, but the daughter still has a role and she has to do everything that she needs to do properly or she won't get there. That's God's ongoing providential care. In light of what we're talking about, isn't that miraculous all on its own? Why is the world the way it is? Why do things grow? Why are there seasons? Why is it that every time you put a seed in the soil it grows instead of only 30% or 20%, or you just never know what might happen? Why is there predictability in the universe that allows us to go about our day-to-day life and care for ourselves? Because God has made things in that way. That's the system. That's the providential care. And that was almost spilled coffee. So what are we saying when we want a miracle? Just want you to understand this. We're saying, I would like God to intervene in the system and override the system in some way, or at least as I understand it. But I want you to keep in mind this. Miracle, or what we'll say supernatural versus natural, is only a matter of perspective. To us, it's supernatural because we don't understand how it works. To God, it is not at all supernatural. What we call supernatural is only natural to God. God goes into His own system that He built and He turns a screw. And I know this is metaphorical because I'm sure that's not the way the universe works. I'm sure there's not screws in the universe. But God does this or tweaks something and everything is back to normal. But that's very natural for God. It's no different than you walking out in your backyard and pulling a weed or doing something and you understand it. And so you go about doing it. So what we're asking God to do in a miraculous situation is come into the system that He built and make a small adjustment to the system so that we derive a benefit from it. So the question is, why? Why would God choose to do this? We expect Him to do it all the time. Is that possible? Could the universe run on nothing but exceptions to the rule? Do you understand what I'm asking? Would it be possible for the abnormal to be the normal? I just want you to hold that thought because sometimes I think, have you ever had a childish understanding of God and grown out of it? I mean, I hope so. We all need to do that. But sometimes we have ridiculous expectations for God. Philosophers have them too, right? We've heard these. Is God powerful enough to make a rock that He can't lift, right? Come on, surely you've heard that. You've never heard that? Is God so powerful that He could create something that He couldn't lift? See, these are the ridiculous questions that kids ask because they're cute, because they don't understand the proper relationship between power and what power is. All right, so let's turn over to the book of John. Have I bored y'all, or are you still somewhat engaged with this? Because I know that we got to go through this, we got to kind of go through this swamp where we see miracles for what they are and understand that they have a purpose and understand that it's not that God doesn't care all the time that He doesn't answer something. We have to understand that God may have higher purposes or reasons for why He doesn't understand something. It could be our growth. It could be because it doesn't align with the rest of what's happening in the family. We looked at that. You can't make everybody necessarily happy at the same time. Right? The people who are praying for rain for their crops and the people in the same community are praying for a nice day for their picnic. I mean, you can't make them both happy. So what is the purpose for miracles? We're going over to John. We're going to the 20th chapter. Going to the very end of the chapter. And let's just talk a little bit about this book. So early on, the gospel writers, we call them the gospel writers, they're gospel doers. They're not really gospel writers until later in their lives. And they're not only because they're busy, but they're not gospel writers also because in their minds, and we're going to see this in a couple of minutes, but in their minds, they expected Jesus to come back shortly. So, hypothetically speaking here, if you knew the world was going to end in 5 years, would you write a book of history of what has happened? No, because it would be irrelevant in 5 years, so you wouldn't bother to write it. But as these men age and they become acquainted, more acquainted with their mortality, And they start to be aware for the first time, you know, maybe Jesus isn't returning immediately in the sense that he's going to return within the generation that saw him. We want to get some things down before we pass away because we want to make sure that this is carefully and accurately preserved. So John is distinguished from the other three Gospels because John selectively sets out to write things. Let's pick up with his own words. Now Jesus did many other signs, in other words, signs besides the ones that John's written about, in the presence of the disciples. But they're not written in this book. But the ones that I have written about, and I'm kind of like paraphrasing this a little bit to make it more personal, but the ones that I have written about here are so that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in His name. So John selects a collection of Jesus' teachings, Jesus' stories, Jesus' interaction with people. For what reason? Huh? Right, that's why they're all recorded. So John looks at miracles and he says, I want to tell these stories in a way that will help other people to have confidence in God. So John's perspective in writing is generations out and saying, whatever you read in this letter of mine, I want you to understand that it's here for your benefit so that you, in reading it, will have some confidence. All right, turn over to Acts 10. So we're going to go to the 34th verse. So this is some years out from Pentecost. It's nowhere near 10 years out. Peter's had a dream. He's had this sheet dream with the weird foods coming down, and he says, no, I can't eat them. You know that would defile me, Lord. And then the sheet comes down again, and then the sheet comes down a third time. And it says he's still puzzling over what the meaning of this dream is when he has this visitor show up and invite him to come talk to some people. So Peter gets there and he's starting to put the pieces together. Everybody's assembled. Everybody's ready to hear what Peter has to say. And so Peter opened his mouth and said, truly I understand that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him and does what is right is acceptable to him. As for the word that he sent to Israel, preaching good news of peace through Jesus Christ, he is the Lord of all. You yourselves know what happened throughout Judea, beginning with Galilee, after the baptism that John proclaimed. How God anointed Jesus of Nazareth. Okay, so he's saying this is common knowledge. So John is writing to future generations. Peter right here is speaking to a current generation. And he's saying, at very least, you have some inkling or some awareness of what's happened around you and this Jesus. How God anointed Jesus with the Holy Spirit and with power. And he went about doing good, healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. So right there, Peter divides this into two things. What does he say, if you were following along, what does he say that Jesus did? One of these refreshing moments where you know you've really made an impact in people's lives. Okay, doing good and then performing these miraculous things that lifted the oppression of the devil off of people. So why does he make that distinction? So what is doing good? If he lumps everything that Jesus did into two categories, Jesus went about doing good and healing. And he sees them as two separate categories. And remember, Peter is an eyewitness to this stuff. So we want to take this seriously. If you want to take any stock in this book as a whole, this is an eyewitness account. This is somebody who watched this and some years after that, 3, 4, 5, reflecting on it, says, essentially you could divide everything that Jesus did into two separate categories. He went around doing good and he went around healing people. So, Jesus' teaching would be doing good. Was it miraculous that Jesus was there? Yeah. It was, wasn't it? Everything about the birth of Jesus, everything about Jesus' life, it's miraculous. And Peter says, one of the miraculous things or qualities or natures about God in flesh, who is Jesus, is that he went around doing good. In other words, he went about telling people the truth. So when God gives us the truth as a means to live by, has he not miraculously acted in our lives? See, I'm not trying to come up with cute rationalizations for why God doesn't act. What I'm trying to do is... here's what I'm trying to do. When Greg's daughter returns with the car at the end of the night, she doesn't say, "Thanks, Dad, this was great, you're the best dad ever. I am so glad you went to work all last year so that you could make the car payment so that I could have that car." Well, she didn't, did she? No, I didn't think so. She expects it. She takes it for granted. Here's the first thing that I'm saying. I think we are swimming in a world of miracles and we don't appreciate it because we take it all for granted because it's the world we were born into. So all I'm asking us to do is, before we're too hard on God in this relationship and say, "God doesn't care about me, God isn't interested in my affairs, and I'm scared to death to pray to God because it doesn't seem he answers anything anyway, so I don't want more confirmed about how little I think God is involved in my life." Instead of that, why don't we see God's providential care all around us already? He went about doing good, healing all who were oppressed by the devil, for God was with him. And we are witnesses of all that he did, both in the country of the Jews and in Jerusalem. Isn't this good to know? Because this now distinguishes two different categories of people. He says, Jesus didn't just do good stuff for the really good religious people. Jesus went out into the countryside. You know what they used to call people who lived out in the country and weren't educated? You're going to like this. You've probably heard this, but you just don't remember it right now. They were called pagans. Pagans, as opposed to civilized people, the pagans were uneducated. We've reconfigured that word and we say pagans are people who don't believe or believe in a different way. Originally, pagans were simply undereducated, not knowledgeable people. And it says Jesus went out into all of the rural lands. So he wasn't selective. Isn't that really good news? Have you ever thought that you weren't religious enough? Or are you thankful that you're not religious? Are you really glad you're not religious? Have you ever said to yourself, "I would never want to be like them"? Well, Jesus went out and did that stuff for us too. And we are witnesses of all that he did. And they put him to death by hanging him on a tree, but God raised him on the third day and made him to appear, not to all people. This is instructive right here. Not to all people, but to us who have been chosen by God as witnesses, who ate and drank with him after he rose from the dead. Now, I don't have time to unpack all the significance and implication of that, but here's what I want you to see. It says, this is Peter. Right? So he saw this whole thing and he says, Jesus didn't reveal himself after his resurrection to everybody, but he only revealed himself to select people. In other words, only certain people were privileged to see firsthand the miracle. Why? And he commanded us to preach to the people and to testify that he is the one appointed by God to be the judge of the living and the dead. Do you understand what he's saying? We were privileged to see this miracle not because it was to benefit us. The whole purpose to being eyewitnesses to the miracle, and if there's a miracle performed in your own life, you're an eyewitness to it. The whole purpose for the miracle was not for your benefit, not for your edification, not to make you feel good. It was because it would give you the confidence to go out and proclaim. That's it. So at very least, sometimes we have to ask, why do I want this miracle? And we talk about, James talks about money, and he says, that, you know, sometimes you ask God for things, and God doesn't answer your prayers. Why? Sometimes you pray to God for things, and God does not answer your prayers because you want to use it on your own selfish pursuits, James says. So here's the question. I am certainly not going to level against any of you the charge of you want to use this miracle in a selfish way. I want you to ask yourself, why are you asking God for a miracle? What is it that you want God to do that it would be impossible for you to live your life without God doing? Is there another way? And do you remember, and I want to combine this with something else, do you remember the couple of weeks ago where we said Jesus is talking about prayer, and he says that when you ask God for something, expect that you're going to get it, because you as fathers, if your kid asked for a stone or for a bread, you wouldn't give him a stone. And we saw that in that, prayer is very often complex. That when you think of the entire process of making bread, it takes time. It takes planning. It takes careful action over a period of time. Is a miracle any less miraculous when it happens over 10 years than if it happens over one? And I know that's a rhetorical question. It's very unsatisfying because we like miracles the way Hollywood makes them, right? There's a little bit of magic, there's some screen effects, and then something is significantly different than it used to be. Maybe there's a poof that comes along with it. I don't know. Would that be right? Maybe some lightning from heaven would be useful. But if you couldn't do it in a day, and you couldn't do it in a week, and you couldn't do it in a decade, and it's done in a decade, is it any less miraculous if God steps in a period of time? Do you know what God describes when he says that the people enter the land of Israel and they come in there? Why isn't the entire land evacuated at once? Why doesn't God just clear house so that they can walk right in? And his explanation is, I've left some of these people in the land to test you and to develop your soldiers over the next number of years. Can you imagine that? I mean, there must have been some strategy sessions where Joshua and the gang are, they're sitting there and they're trying to plot how they're going to take the next city. And somebody says from the back of the room, well, you know, if God is all this and then some, it would sure be good if he just wiped these people out and then we wouldn't have to deal with all this. Don't we ask the same kind of questions today about God and make the same hypotheticals about God? And if God was really God, wouldn't he do this or that or the other thing? But where would be the growth for us in that? There'd be none.